Now, Jill Bevilacqua is back with our weekly radio drama, The Vatican Centuries, looking at the people and places who made up the history of the Vatican. Episode 13 is entitled The Treasure House.
For 500 years after the fall of Rome, Europe languished in the limbo of the Dark Ages. But after the barbarian flood had abated, the memory and the legend of the empire revived and began to haunt the imagination.
With the birth of the new religion of Islam and the Arabs in control of the Mediterranean, seaborne trade had decreased, and the empire of Byzantium gradually lost its hold over the West.
The popes were compelled to seek help from the Franks against the Lombards, and the connection between the papacy and the Frankish monarchy was forged.
This connection was to affect papal history decisively for the next five centuries, and gave it the authority to play a significant role in the future history of Europe.
By the middle of the 8th century, the Vatican Hill had taken on the aspect of a regular district. Around St. Peter's Basilica, the buildings had mushroomed. There were tombs, chapels, churches, convents, residences for visiting bishops, pilgrims' hostels, and a building destined to house all those who worked for the Vatican.
It was at this time that a bell tower, the first in Rome, was added to St. Peter's. Pope Stephen II was the innovator, and in the fashion of the time, he covered the tower with gold and silver. Stephen also built a chapel to St. Petronilla, who was believed to be St. Peter's daughter, and transferred her remains there from the catacombs. Incidentally, it was Stephen who began the construction of the convent of San Silvestro in Capite, whose church today is the Church of the English in Rome.
Stephen founded a considerable number of guest houses for pilgrims, and of these, we're told, the most ardent and enthusiastic were the Angles. One of these, a certain Aedberger, abbess of Minster in Isle of Thanet, wrote to St. Boniface, the English missionary who was evangelizing Germany, for advice about making a pilgrimage to Rome.
Boniface answered in true non-committal English style.
Be it known to you, dear sister, that in regard to the matter on which you have sought my advice, I cannot presume on my own responsibility either to forbid your pilgrimage or to encourage it. I can only say how the matter appears to me. If, for the sake of solitude and divine contemplation, you have forsaken the monastic life and the care of your subjects, the servants and handmaidens of God, how can you bring yourself to submit to the orders and whims of men of this world and the labor and anxiety they entail? If you cannot find freedom and peace of mind in your native land, you should try, provided you have the will and the power to do so, to find freedom for contemplation by making a pilgrimage abroad. This is what our sister Withberger did. She has told me by letter that she has found at the shrine of St. Peter the kind of quiet life which she had long sought for in vain. Since I had written to her about your intentions, she sent me word that you would do better to wait until the attacks and the threats of the Saracens against Rome had died down, and until she herself could send you an invitation. To me also, this seems the better plan. Make all necessary preparations for the journey, wait for word from her, and afterwards do what God's grace shall inspire you to do.
The abbess made her pilgrimage, and all was well. But several years later, Boniface became concerned at tales told by pilgrims returning from Rome. All was not as it should be in the Eternal City. In 742, Boniface wrote to Pope Zacharias, congratulating him on his accession to the papacy, and gently brought the matter to the Pope's attention.
Because the Alemannians, Bavarians, and Franks see that some of these abuses which we condemn are rife in Rome, they think that the priests there allow them, and on that account they reproach us and take bad example. They say that in Rome, near the Church of St. Peter, they have seen throngs of people parading the streets at the beginning of January of each year, shouting and singing songs in pagan fashion, loading tables with food and drink from morning till night, and that during that time no man is willing to lend his neighbour fire or tools or anything useful from his own house. They recount also that they have seen women wearing pagan amulets and bracelets on their arms and legs and offering them for sale. All such abuses, witnessed by sensual and ignorant people, bring reproach upon us here and frustrate our work of preaching and teaching. If Your Holiness would put an end to these heathen customs in Rome, it would redound to your credit, besides promoting the success of our teaching of the faith.
As the centuries followed each other, the great Basilica of St. Peter grew in splendour and magnificence. The tomb of Peter, besides being a powerful spiritual magnet for men and monarchs, had become a dazzling treasure house.
In the early 7th century, Pope Honorius I recovered the roof with bronze tiles, and to the centre door, which was only opened on grand occasions, he attached silver ornaments. The Liber Pontificalis tells us that 975 pounds of silver was used in this work, and from then on, the door was known as the Porta Argentea. When the Saracens descended on the city 2 centuries later, the door was robbed of its silver plates, and they had to be substituted by bronze ones.
Pope Sergius I was particularly concerned to preserve the Roman basilicas and enriched them with precious furnishings. The mosaic and bronze workers of Rome vied with those of Constantinople in the embellishment of the city's churches, St. Peter's above all. Nor did the pilgrim kings come empty-handed, but bearing gifts of gold for the Prince of the Apostles.
Sergius I also created a precedent. Until then, all the popes had been buried either in the cemeteries outside the walls or in the atrium of the basilica. But in 688, Sergius placed the body of Leo I in a new tomb at the centre of the nave and erected an altar over it. From that time on, the more distinguished popes were given burial inside St. Peter's.
Other popes added chapels. In 706, John VII dedicated the chapel of the Nativity, decorating it with mosaics of the Virgin and the Apostles Peter and Paul. The relics of this chapel can still be seen in the Vatican grottos.
Gregory II built a chapel and filled it with paintings. And in his time, the bronze statue of St. Peter, still there today, acquired a certain notoriety. The Byzantine Emperor Leo III had issued an edict forbidding the use of images in Christian worship in the churches of the East. And the statue of St. Peter became the object of his particular hate. The practice of kissing the statue's foot, still observed in our own time, was encouraged by Pope Gregory in defiance of the Eastern Emperor.
No one knows exactly when or how the statue appeared in St. Peter's. Legend has it that Pope Leo I had it made after melting down a statue of Jupiter. Certainly, it's been around since the 5th century and is recognised to be of much earlier date than the Byzantine period. Moreover, this image of St. Peter, with its short, curly hair and round, cut beard, fixed the physiognomy of the saint for all future generations.
The iconoclastic movement was still raging when Gregory III succeeded to the papal throne. He promptly called a council at which the image breakers were excommunicated, and this served as a definitive break with Constantinople. When the Exarch of Ravenna gave the Pope 6 spiral onyx columns, Gregory placed them in front of St. Peter's confession and covered them with silver plates, boldly engraved with figures of the Saviour, the Apostles, and the Saints.
Hadrian I, who reigned for 23 years, was responsible for a considerable amount of reconstruction work. Apart from reinforcing the city walls and repairing the aqueducts, he built many new churches and restored the old ones. He strengthened the foundations of the portico which led from the river to the basilica with 12,000 blocks of stone. He renovated the steps and the entrance to St. Peter's and added bronze doors to the bell tower.
Hadrian also added a touch of grandeur to his building work. The pavement in front of St. Peter's shrine he had covered with silver, the interior with gold. He replaced the silver statues on the tomb with solid gold effigies of the Saviour, the Virgin Mary, Saints Peter, Paul, and Andrew. The altar itself he covered with finely wrought gold, and above it he hung a gigantic chandelier in the form of a cross.
On feast days, when purple drapes embroidered with gold hung between the columns of the naves, and the chandelier was ablaze with the light of over 1,000 candles, the Church of St. Peter's must have been a magnificent sight.
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua, who wrote and presented The Vatican Centuries. You can hear episode 14 at this same time next week.